Hey, I'm Scott. This is my show, the goddamn show. The Scott Horton Show, that's what they call it. Yeah, I'm him. It's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Yeah, I got a chip on my shoulder about the empire. And I'm sick and tired of it, actually. Yeah, alright. So that's what the show's about. Me complaining about the empire. Welcome to it. I did an interview with Tom Woods a little while ago. Talked all about the Islamic State. That'll be playing on Tom's show on Friday. The great Tom Woods. Yes, it's true. We planned to write a book, but hadn't yet. Maybe we'll. Wow. Well, god dang. That's it. Hang on. God dang this mouse. Do what I tell you, mouse! Yeah. So, Daniel Stephen Waltz is going to be on. Writes for Foreign Policy. Author of The Israel Lobby. And a very interesting guy. He's not a libertarian non-interventionist like us, but he's all right. Yeah, man. And I got some news to cover. A ton of news. Some things are surprising. Some things surprise even me. Hey, I got a tweet this morning from a guy. Said, hey, Scott, you got to play some of that fascism versus capitalism on the show. Because I'd like to hear some of it. Or something like that. And I thought, hey, you know, that's a pretty good idea. Fascism versus capitalism. That's Lou Rockwell's book. And I did the audio book of it. And it's on sale now at Amazon.com and Audible.com and iTunes.com, I guess. Anyway. So, yeah, man. I think I'm going to do that. Play some audio from Fascism versus Capitalism. Maybe you'll like it. Also, there's a chance that Jason Ditz is going to be on the show. He's the managing news editor at news.antiwar.com. And I need an update on all the bad news out of Yemen and Libya. And I'm just too damn lazy to go and find a good reporter who's covering one and the other today. So I'm just going to call on Jason because he knows everything about everything. I would interview him every day, but wouldn't want to wear it out. It's a special thing, you know. Bright guy. He's on top of everything. He writes all the bad news every day at antiwar.com, news.antiwar.com. I got a message out to him. Haven't heard back, but he's pretty reliable about this kind of thing, man, and chances are he can probably do it. So we'll see about that. And now, yeah, you know, let's see. No, I didn't talk to him. Oh, man, I know. That's what I should have done. You know, I was trying to find David Stockman's number. I wanted to interview him about the Greece thing, but I couldn't find it. I got something, man. So. Stockman wrote a thing. We're running it on antiwar.com today, and he's celebrating. He's the former Reagan budget director guy, and now very Austrian, that is, extremely free market in his outlook. And he's praising the communist leader of Greece for refusing to go along with the bailout package because it's going to pop the bubble of the whole EU. And that's what we need for prices to find themselves again. We need a correction. The power and influence of the governments and their central banks and their money machines and the problems that they cause. I love David Stockman. You know, my favorite thing to ever tell anyone is about how everything wrong in the whole world is because of Woodrow Wilson. It's all his fault, and the god dang Democrats and the central bank and all their wars and everything horrible that's ever happened since, including Nazism and communism and Mao Zedong and everything. And you can read at David Stockman's Contra Corner him giving his speech like that. And oh my God, it's only about 700,000 million jillion times better than mine. It's exactly what I got to say about it, only just so much better that it put me on an ice floe out to sea. I become absolutely worthless in comparison to his incredible narrative about everything wrong that's happened since Woodrow Wilson got his central bank and got us into the Great War. Bastards. David Stockman. Three cheers for him, dude. And you know what? It's always hard to find when I Google it. I never can remember the title of this thing. And he's written along these same lines a lot of times. So now I think at the break I'm going to have to figure out, now that I've praised this single essay, it's actually a speech that he gave. I'm going to have to find the article during the break for you and see if I can recommend it by name. Because he's written, he's written a thing about, you know, the fulcrum of Sarajevo, but that's not it. And he's talking about World War One there. But that's not it. It's a different one. It's kind of hard to find when you Google it. I'm going to find it for you during the break. The greatest, it's the greatest thing since Wall Street Banks and American Foreign Policy by Murray Rothbard. That's what it is. As far as catching your ass up on the last century of how everything pretty much went wrong. Except for the things that didn't. But, of course, the most violent century in the history of the world. And I think even like pound for pound, right? Not just because there were more people to be killed, but that Industrial Revolution, man, it brought some severe power to bear. Well, and of course, Mao just starved 40 million people to death. Nothing too high tech about that. I saw a thing recently. Did you guys see that thing? I retweeted it. It was a graphic of all the dead of World War II, and he compares. It's just great, you know, 21st century graphics to help you understand how many people were killed in World War II and the various parts of it and this and that. And then, but part of what he does is compare it to all the, worst catastrophes in human history. And Mao Zedong is second place behind World War II. You realize that? Genghis Khan and Tamerlane and Saddam Hussein and all the George Bushes combined. Nothing compared to Mao. Between 40 and 60 million people killed when World War II, all of World War II, was between 60 and 70, they say now. I always thought, you know, between 50 and 60, which when your rounding error is 10 million human lives, then there's some real problem going on. Mm-hmm. But Mao Zedong, his dictatorship of communism in China killed almost as many people as all of World War II. Isn't that incredible? Man, that's incredible. Anyway, and especially when you compare it back to all the scaremongering about China back then. Very little information coming out of China, so they must be doing real good. Getting ready to get us. What time is it? Oh, good. I don't have to say too much more this segment. I'm almost done for this segment. I gotta talk about Napolitano. Judge Napolitano has written a great new article for LouRockwell.com and, well, for his, it's a syndicated column. It'll be at antiwar.com and LouRockwell.com both tomorrow. And it's all about what has been learned of substance from Hillary's emails so far, particularly about the controversy over the war in Libya. Good, good stuff from Judge Napolitano. I think I'll probably get into that next. Nah, I'll do the fascism versus capitalism thing next, maybe. Or I might talk a little bit about some church burnings. I don't know. Oh, and Egypt. Oh, and did you hear there was maybe an attempted coup in Mosul? What about that? Scott Horton Show. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Yeah, see, I'm having trouble finding it. I mean, this one is even called The Epical Consequences of Woodrow Wilson's War, but I don't think that's it. I don't think that's the one. It's a good one. But I don't think that's the one that I'm looking for. There's the Sarajevo is the Fulcrum of Modern History, another really good one, but I still don't think that's the one I'm... David Stockman and his best article that anyone ever wrote. Sorry, I'm mumbling. David Stockman and the best article anyone ever wrote. I gotta find it. Let me see. Where the hell is it? Maybe that was it. I don't think so, though. I think it was longer than that giant thing. And I don't remember it being full of all Proposition 1, 2, and 3 like that. That was something else. Because the one that I'm thinking of, it starts with World War I. And it blames Woodrow Wilson just right and everything, but then it goes on and on all the way through, see? Up to the current day. Everything you need to know. Oh, you know what it is, though? It was a speech at the same thing, though. That this other one was. Maybe this was it. At the Committee for the Republic. This is something in Washington, D.C. where decent people give speeches. I don't know much about it. But I know decent people give speeches there sometimes. So let me search for that at David Stockman's Contra Corner. Oh, this is it, dude. This is the one. Yeah. Okay. It's a 6-part series. This is a huge speech. It's the most ridiculously long, ridiculous thing, but it's great. It's so great. It's called Keynesian Myths, Monetary Central Planning, and the Triumph of the Warfare State. See, that's why I can never remember the damn title. Keynesian Myths, Monetary Central Planning, and the Triumph of the Warfare State. It is so good. You gotta read it. It'll make your brain a better place after that, dude. You'll be, I don't know, smarter, but you'll know more stuff. You will have greater wisdom. If you go to David Stockman's ContraCorner.com and you look up Keynesian Myths, Monetary Central Planning, and the Triumph of the Warfare State. It's the greatest thing that anybody ever wrote about what you don't know but should. How do you like that? It's exactly what I would have told you if I was a real scholar who actually knew what he was talking about. Right? I'm like... third hand. I'm the guy that passes on what this guy knows. Not to sell myself too short or anything. But it's all right. I'm used to it. I've always been kind of short, so it's not a big deal. All right. Hey, it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm at LRN.FM, the Liberty Radio Network. Like always, ScottHorton.org is my website. Join up the chat room. If you want to join up the chat room, it's ScottHorton.org/chat. And yes, it's true. It's fundraising time at the Scott Horton Show. Please work thing that I clicked on. Okay, guys, it's summer fun drive time at the Scott Horton Show. Bills are piling up and equipment is wearing out. So here's the deal. Anyone who donates $50 or more gets a chance to win a week's vacation for two to Costa Rica. Drawing is July 15th. Winner, go whenever you want. See more details at scotthorton.org/raffle. Anyone who donates $100 or more gets entered into the raffle, plus a 1 ounce silver QR code commodity disc from commoditydiscs.com. And the first 25 people to donate $100 or more will also get a copy of Your Money or Your Life, Why We Must Abolish the Income Tax by Sheldon Richmond, or the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism versus Capitalism, narrated by me, for free. Stop by scotthorton.org/donate or scotthorton.org/raffle for details. You can also sign up for monthly donations by way of PayPal, per interview at Patreon, support with Bitcoin, and shop through scotthorton.org/Amazon. And thanks. All right, so there you go. Sorry to keep beating you over the head with that, but I need your money. As much of it as you can afford to send. As much of it as you think this show is worth to you. Yeah, we're all about the subjective theory of value here, man. All right, let me see. Stephen Walt, he's coming up on the show, so don't go away too far. There's so much different stuff to talk about. I'm not sure where to begin. First of all, church burnings. There's been 6 or 8 or something. But then the FBI says they think only 2 of them were arsons. Does that sound right to you? There's an anonymous source in USA Today today saying that the church that burnt down last night, almost completely, virtually completely, and I think that one was in South Carolina, and one that was burnt 20 years ago by the KKK, that it was an accident. They don't think it was arson at all, but they didn't provide another explanation, although another article I read said that there was a severe lightning storm in that town last night, so maybe it really was just an accident. I don't know. But I do know that whenever the KKK or the Nazis are actually doing stuff, if we can assume that any of these fires are, plots by organized white supremacists, then it's the cops. Just like we are supposedly to be considered innocent until we're proven guilty and convicted in court, all government officials should be presumed guilty. Right? They all must be guilty of lying if we're presumed innocent. They're presumed full of it. Well, whenever something explodes, they ought to be presumed the ones behind it. And if it's not, an outright government plot, they're always, failing completely to stop real attacks. It's like the Boston attack happened at the marathon there. While the FBI was chasing their tail and trapping that guy into the remote control plane plot. The Boston FBI. Hey, you stupid idiot kid. Let me help you feel important for a minute and maybe give you some money. And all I need you to do is say you love Osama and you're willing to fly a remote control plane full of whatever. Biological weapons. Into the Capitol. Yeah, sure. You'll give me $20,000 to say that? Says the idiot. Oh, look, everybody, we saved you from terrorism. And then meanwhile, bang, and 3 innocent people die. Scores wounded. But yeah, whenever the Nazis are robbing banks, 1 or 6 of them, undercover informants. Whenever they're plotting to blow up the Oklahoma City building, 9 or 20 of them are government informants. As someone was joking on my Twitter feed this morning, is there such a thing as a Klansman that's not a deep cover law enforcement officer? Is there such a thing as a law enforcement officer that's not a deep cover Klansman? Aha, yeah, see? Now we're getting somewhere. Just search PatCon and get back to me. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Chapter 9. The Misesian Vision. January 25th, 2010. I'm finding it ever more difficult to describe to people the kind of world that the Mises Institute would like to see, with the type of political order that Mises and the entire classical liberal tradition believed would be the most beneficial for mankind. It would appear that the more liberty we lose, the less people are able to imagine how liberty might work. It's a fascinating thing to behold. People can no longer imagine a world in which we could be secure without massive invasions of our privacy at every step, and even being strip-searched before boarding airplanes, even though private institutions manage much greater security without any invasions of human rights. People can no longer remember how a true free market in medical care would work, even though all the problems of the current system were created by government interventions in the first place. People imagine that we need 700 military bases around the world and endless wars in the Middle East for security, though safe Switzerland doesn't. People think it is insane to think of life without central banks, even though they are modern inventions that have destroyed currency after currency. Even meddlesome agencies like the Consumer Product Safety Commission or the Federal Trade Commission strike most people as absolutely essential, even though it is not they who catch the thieves and frauds, but private institutions. The idea of privatizing roads or water supplies sounds outlandish, even though we have a long history of both. People even wonder how anyone would be educated in the absence of public schools, as if markets themselves didn't create in America the world's most literate society in the 18th and 19th centuries. This list could go on and on, but the problem is that the capacity to imagine freedom, the very source of life for civilization and humanity itself, is being eroded in our society and culture. The less freedom we have, the less people are able to imagine what freedom feels like, and therefore the less they're willing to fight for its restoration. This has profoundly affected the political culture. We've lived through regime after regime since at least the 1930s, in which the word freedom has been a rhetorical principle only, even as each new regime has taken away ever more freedom. Now we have a president who doesn't even bother to pay lip service to the idea of freedom. In fact, I don't think that the idea has occurred to Obama at all. If the idea of freedom has occurred to him, he must have rejected it as dangerous or unfair or unequal or irresponsible or something along those lines. To him, and to many Americans, the goal of government is to be an extension of the personal values of those in charge. I saw a speech in which Obama was making a pitch for national service, the ghastly idea that government should steal 2 years of every young person's life for slave labor and to inculcate loyalty to the Leviathan, with no concerns about setting back a young person's professional and personal life. How did Obama justify his support of this idea? He said that when he was a young man, he learned important values from his period of community service. It helped form him and shape him. It helped him understand the troubles of others and think outside of his own narrow experience. Well, I'm happy for him, but he chose that path voluntarily. It is a gigantic leap to go from personal experience to forcing a vicious national plan on the entire country. His presumption here is really taken from the playbook of the totalitarian state. The father leader will guide his children citizens in the path of righteousness, so that they all will become God like the leader himself. To me, Obama's comment illustrates one of two things. It could show that Obama is a potential dictator in the mold of Stalin, Hitler, and Mao, for the presumptions he puts on exhibit here are just as frightening as any imagined by the worst tyrants in human history. Or, more plausibly, it may be an illustration of Hannah Arendt's view that totalitarianism is merely an application of the principle of the banality of evil. With this phrase, Arendt meant to draw attention to how people misunderstand the origin and nature of evil regimes. Evil regimes are not always the product of fanatics, paranoids, and sociopaths. Though, of course, power breeds fanaticism, paranoia, and sociopathology. Instead, the total state can be built by ordinary people who accept a wrong premise concerning the role of the state in society. If the role of the state is to ferret out evil thoughts and bad ideas, it must necessarily become totalitarian. If the goal of the state is that all citizens must come to hold the same values as the great leader, whether economic, moral, or cultural, the state must necessarily become totalitarian. If the people are led to believe that scarce resources are best channeled in a direction that producers and consumers would not choose on their own, the result must necessarily be central planning. On the face of it, many people today do not necessarily reject these premises. No longer is the idea of a state-planned society seen as frightening. What scares people more today is the prospect of a society without a plan, which is to say, a society of freedom. But here is the key difference between authority in everyday life, such as that exercised by a parent or a teacher or a pastor or a boss, and the power of the state. The state's edicts are always and everywhere enforced at the point of a gun. It is interesting how little we think about that reality. One virtually never hears that truth stated so plainly in a college classroom, for example, but it is the core reality. Everything done by the state is ultimately done by means of aggression, which is to say violence or the threat of violence against the innocent. The total state is really nothing but the continued extension of these statist means throughout every nook and cranny of economic and social life. Thus does the paranoia, megalomania, and fanaticism of the rulers become deadly dangerous to everyone. It begins in a seemingly small error, a banality. But, with the state, what begins in banality ends in bloodshed. Let me give another example of the banality of evil. Several decades ago, some crackpots had the idea that mankind's use of fossil fuels had a warming effect on the weather. Environmentalists were pretty fired up by the notion. So were many politicians. Economists were largely tongue-tied because they had long ago conceded that there are some public goods that the market can't handle. Surely the weather is one of them. Enough years go by, and what do you have? Politicians from all over the world. Every last one of them a huckster of some sort, only pretending to represent his nation, gathering in a posh resort in Europe to tax the world and planet's weather down to precise temperatures half a century from now. In the entire history of mankind, there has not been a more preposterous spectacle than this. I don't know if it is tragedy or farce that the meeting on global warming came to an end with the politicians racing home to deal with snowstorms and record cold temperatures. I draw attention to this absurdity to make a more general point. What seems to have escaped the current generation is the notion that was once called freedom. Let me be clear on what I mean by freedom. I mean a social or political condition in which people exercise their own choices concerning what they do with their lives and property. People are permitted to trade and exchange goods and services without impediment or violent interference. They can associate or not associate with anyone of their own choosing. They can arrange their own lives and businesses. They can build, move, innovate, save, invest, and consume on terms that they themselves define. What will be the result? We cannot predict them, any more than I can know when everyone in this room will wake up tomorrow morning or what you will have for breakfast. Human choice works this way. There are as many patterns of human choice as there are humans who will make choices. The only real question we should ask is whether the results will be orderly, consistent with peace and prosperity, or chaotic, and thereby at war with human flourishing. The great burden borne by the classical liberal tradition, stretching from medieval times to our own, is to make believable the otherwise improbable claim that liberty is the mother, not the daughter, of orderliness. To be sure, that generation of Americans that seceded from British rule in the late 18th century took the imperative...
All right, buy it today. Fascism versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell, narrated by me. Find the link at my website, scotthorton.org, on the right side there. It's at amazon.com, Audible, and iTunes. Fascism versus Capitalism. Get it free if you donate $100 to the show. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
Hey, I'm Scott. How's it going?
Let's see. Yeah. Yeah, ain't that nice.
Hey, join up the chat room, everybody, if you want to. ScottHorton.org/chat. Y'all want to do some phone calls, man? We got the telephone thingamajiggy all fixed. Our good friend Smiles Lewis from AnomalyRadio.com.
He's letting me use his phone rig. That's what he's doing.
The number is 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. If anybody wants to call up and cuss me out, you know, don't use any real cuss words. It's a radio show, man, but whatever. You want to call in and, say whatever you want, okay? Talk about whatever you want. Preferably, you know, with a libertarian foreign policy type of a focus of a discussion, but I don't care, man. You know, whatever you want. I should have a question of the day. I never do this right. So, I guess the question of the day is, how long do you think the Islamic State is going to last? And don't just say as long as the CIA keeps giving them money and guns, because that's too easy. No, it's, I think the Turks are the ones who are giving them the money and guns, and the Americans are giving the money and guns to the Turks, and just, yeah, you know. And this is going to be one of the things I talk with Walt about, too. The daylight between America and its allies and the arming our enemies business, because it doesn't seem like there's really very much of it. Anyway, we're going to get to that. Yeah, so check this out. I don't know if this is a question of the day or anything, but ISIS just executed its top official in Mosul for planning a coup. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know. Maybe it's not. It's just an Iraqi paper said that. That would be cool, though. And, you know, I think, you know, basically the Islamic State is run by some extremely ruthless, murderous sons of bitches. And people like that, they usually care only about themselves. Even, you know, as badly as Republicans and Democrats and American generals do. And so, yeah, you know, I've been kind of counting on this. That's why I like the idea. The report comes in and I say, oh, good. Look, see, it's happening. These guys are horrible bastards. So what does that mean? That means everywhere they go, they surround themselves with enemies, and including the people that they've conquered, too. Not just outside their borders, but inside them, too. And you take the self-interestedness and the personal bloodthirstiness, take the self-interestedness of the Republicans and Democrats with the personal ruthlessness of these Islamic State guys, and it's not hard to imagine people at the highest levels literally murdering each other, not waiting for later or whatever, you know? So, I'd like to see it, and I think, I don't know. It's a very oversimplified retelling of some stuff that I've read, but it seems basically like in Iraqi Sunni stand. I know less about Syria, I guess. But it seems like in Iraqi Sunni stand, you got three major kind of power centers. You got the tribal leaders, You've got the local religious leaders. Well, maybe it's four now. The local religious leaders, the genuine, you know, from here ones. And then you have the former Ba'athist officers and the Islamic State. And these are shifting alliances within Iraqi Sunnistan, right? So right now, you have the Islamic State, Bin Ladenite types, allied with the Ba'athist administrators of the military and the government. And then they've got conscription, and they can afford it, apparently, for now. And so they're putting the kind of out-group among the tribes are becoming the foot soldiers of the Islamic State. Because in the tribal system, the people at the top get it all, and the people at the bottom basically have nothing. No women, no nothing. And so they're on the outs. The Islamic State has a different kind of, you know, more of an equality to it. It guarantees those people more of an opportunity, I guess, to a great degree. So, but you have tribal leaders who have a lot to lose, of course, in their own power and influence to the Islamic State and to the Ba'athists coming back into power now. And so, you know, I guess it still remains to be seen, but it seems like these alliances could shift. Because, really, I mean, you got the entire population of Sunnistan. Maybe they hate, you know, they don't want the alternatives, you know, from outside the lines coming in, like the Ba'ath Brigade or something, to so-called liberate them. They don't want that. But do they want to live under the Islamic State for the long term? They're going around conscripting everybody's son and banning smoking and acting like a bunch of Republicans and Democrats everywhere, chopping people's heads off, crucifying them, throwing them from the tops of tall buildings, massacring Shia wherever they can. I mean, I guess they could. I'm kind of counting on them burning themselves out pretty quick there. It doesn't seem like a very good way to get along in the world. And look at the map. They're completely landlocked, and the only people who will trade with them are the Turks, and that's on the black market. So, I don't know. Not that that kind of isolation has guaranteed the destruction of the regime in North Korea or anything like that, but, you know, I don't know. Stephen Walt's coming on the show. His attitude is, eh, let them be the Islamic State. You shouldn't have overthrown Baghdad then. Told you. Now you did. Now this is what happened. So what do you say? And by the way, back to the Napolitano piece. Where is it? Right here. Hang on. So I'm spoiling it for you, man. Hillary's Secret War. It's coming out tomorrow. I won't read it all to you, but in his job at Fox News, he says he reviews documents, you know, with other experts and so forth for their reporting. That's one of his jobs. It's not just punditry on TV, but he helps review legal documents and government documents to tease out meanings that government educated, well, those educated in government and those kinds of documents can do that we can't do, you know, find the read between the lines that we miss. You know, like Marcy Wheeler's job. Even though she was never the state, she's that good at reading the legalese. Anyway, so he says here, he's gone through here and he's found all about how, in these emails, how she provided material assistance to terrorists and lied to Congress, lied under oath to Rand Paul. Oh, and he says it doesn't matter if she was under oath or not, because when you testify before the Senate, you're de facto under oath anyway, and you can be prosecuted for lying anyway, and they've done that before. And anyway, so whether she was sworn in or not, she's guilty of perjury. And she could have just said, listen, that's a classified thing. You're not quite right. I could explain it to you, but not here. She could have said that, but she said, I have no idea what you're talking about. Perjury. And what was it that Rand Paul was talking about? Hey, Hillary, the guys that killed Stevens, these Mujahideen guys, tell me something. Was he helping them run guns to Syria? I've been reading about some guns coming from Libya, landing in Turkey to go to the rebellion there. What can you tell me about that? And she says, Abra, I have no idea what you're talking about, Mr. Rand Paul. Nobody ever asked me that before. You might have to ask the agency over there, meaning the CIA, capital A agency. Not me. But now these documents prove that she moved to license an arms dealer named Mark Torrey, to sell weapons to Qatar so that Qatar could then funnel the weapons to Libya as the cutout, as the plausible deniability, so that Qatar could deliver the weapons to groups that are on the American terrorist list. The State Department's and the Treasury Department's. Oh no, I'm reading that line out of context. The State Department's terrorist list, it is. Torrey sold hundreds of millions of dollars worth of arms to the government of Qatar, which then, at the request of American government officials, were sold, bartered, or given to rebel groups in Libya and Syria. Some of the groups that received the arms were on the U.S. terror list. Thus, the same state and treasury departments that licensed the sales also prohibited them. And, of course, we know who he's talking about. Ansar al-Sharia and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, a.k.a. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, in Libya. We already knew this. By the way, just go to WashingtonTimes.com. I know, but seriously, they got a great four-part series about Hillary and the Libya war there. You gotta look at it. Not just Benghazi, but the whole war.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, man. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. LibertyRadioNetwork.com, LRN.FM. Same difference. ScottHorton.org. Join up the chat room at ScottHorton.org/chat. And if you want, call in. We'll do a couple of calls. We've got Stephen Waltz coming up in a little while. But until then, we could talk about Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Syria. The Islamic State, we could talk about Ukraine and NATO, we could talk Guantanamo Bay, torture, domestic police state, the church burnings and the Klan and the killer cops and whatever the hell you want, man, all that stuff. Looks like we got one caller on the line. You can join up. It's 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. And you are now on the air. Hey, how's it going?
Hi, Scott.
Hi. What's going on?
You can hear me?
Yeah, how you doing?
Well, I started listening to your show last fall after hearing you on the Tom Wood Show.
Great.
And I really appreciate how you, cover all these policy issues and police state issues and everything without turning into, say, Alex Jones.
Well, thank you.
And, since you're willing to talk about, Oklahoma City, I learned a lot about that from you that I didn't know before. My main question is, how do you sift through the official story versus conspiracy, claims, not to turn this into a 9/11 debate, but, there's all the physical, how did they fall so fast and everything. I'm just curious what your perspective is, since you're not too far down the rabbit hole.
Sure. Well,
if you'd be willing to talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, my thing about this is that I was a truther type before 9/11 ever happened. I had predicted that something like it would happen, although my evidence for that is lost, but
on my old radio show on Free Radio Austin in 1999. I talked about how this kind of thing was coming. And Alex Jones, who you mentioned, to his credit, he was predicting something like that, you know, from at least 96 on, that the next big war is the war on terrorism, and they're setting us up for it. He definitely saw that coming. And so, you know, when it happened, of course, I assume, like any critical thinker at the time, you have to immediately start wondering, well, how in the world can you have 24 real-ass Al-Qaeda in the country and the FBI doesn't know about it? There are real questions right there for how that could have happened. And I think most of it actually is explained away by what a bunch of meathead, ridiculous pigs these cops are. And that people just assume that these cops even mean well in the first place, much less they're competent. And it turns out the FBI, the CIA, and the NSA, and those guys all hate each other, refuse to share information with each other. It doesn't even occur to them, apparently, that American innocent civilians that they're in charge of supposedly protecting are going to get killed because they refuse to cooperate with each other. And that accounted for a lot of it. On the other hand, I'm not naive. And I know that Prince Bandar and the Bush family and their associates, James Baker, Baker Botts Law Firm and all that, they're very close to these guys. And that Bandar Bush and Prince Turki Al-Faisal had paid millions in protection money to Al-Qaeda from at least 96 on. And I'm aware that, you know, the majority of the hijackers came from Saudi Arabia, and I don't think the story has ever properly been told about exactly who it was that recruited those guys and put them on the planes to the U.S. and arranged all of that. But on the other hand, I think, well, and okay, there are quite a few more points that I could say, you know, leaning toward the conspiracy point of view. But on the other hand, I gotta say I reject like 99.9% of all the conspiracy crap that you hear about 9/11. I think that, you know, I don't know how much of it is official disinformation or just regular people jumping to conclusions, but so much of it is just nonsense. And that's why I don't really talk about it very much on the show, because it just attracts all the crazies. We never make any progress getting anywhere. I'm still just as suspicious as I was the day it happened, but without much more evidence, really, than I had then. I mean, my real answer, my bottom line is this, caller, is that George Tenet should be put up on gallows with a rope around his neck on top of a trap door, and he ought to be told, you could waterboard him for a little while first if you want. And then he ought to be told that you can start spilling your guts about who all really knew what about these hijackers in the country, what conversations you had with Bush and Cheney about it before it happened, whatever, or we're going to hang you because you're guilty of 3,000 counts of criminally negligent homicide anyway, schmuck. And then, so, I think, you know, maybe we could start getting to the bottom of it that way. But, you know, I doubt that there's a piece of paper anywhere that really is the proof of this, unless somehow the principals can be made to rat on each other. I should also point out, I want to point out one more thing, which is that Egyptian Islamic Jihad and bin Laden's Azzam group that he ended up inheriting after the death of Azzam, they merged together back in the early 90s. They attacked us at the first World Trade Center attack. They attacked the Khobar Towers in 1996. Bin Laden declared his fatwa in 1996. They attacked the African embassies in 1998. They tried to sink a battleship in Yemen but failed in 99. They attacked the coal successfully but failed to sink it in 2000. And that was Al-Qaeda that did it. They had a plot to kill the Pope and Bill Clinton and to bomb 12 planes over the Pacific in 1995. That wasn't all some CIA inside job. I mean, these are real human beings who had a real war against us that they were waging for real reasons. So, and I think that includes the Hamburg cell of hijackers, Mohammed Atta and Ramzi bin al-Sheikh. He wasn't a hijacker. He's alive right now, but they were best friends. He helped coordinate the thing. And I think all that's a legitimate Al-Qaeda operation. The real question, I think, comes down to what all did the principals in the U.S. government know, and when did they know it, and did they have kind of, you know, an idea? We're going to let the next one through so that we can further our agenda. I think that's plausible, but you know what it is? The water is so muddy with such nonsense that it's not fun to go wading in. You know what I mean? It's just...
No, definitely. And it's a hard thing because so many people are like emotionally attached to it, and then you can't really
Yeah, it becomes a religious thing.
Without immediately being said you're crazy. Right.
Well, and both ways. Right. The other way, if you refuse to be 100% truther for bombs on every floor in all three buildings and this and that, well, oh, you're just a coward and you're afraid to admit the real truth and, oh, you love Israel and, oh, and blah, 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 blah. It's the worst. I mean, I actually resent most of the truther. I don't mean the believers, but like the leaders of most of the truther movement, I resent more than the people who actually did the damn attack at this point. They're their best accomplices. When 90% of their proof is a bunch of nonsense. Oh, look, the CIA gave the script of exactly what was going to happen to the BBC, who read the script early. No, right? The BBC reporter's playing telephone game with the people back, and they said the building was about to fall. And then by the time she said it on air, it got screwed up. She said the building had already fallen. But meanwhile, at that exact same time, every other news service in America was reporting the same thing. We just got word the building's about to fall. Everyone get back. So, no, the CIA did not give the entire script of the entire damn day of their inside job plot to the BBC news reader who accidentally read it on air early. That doesn't make any sense. But there's a million of those, right? There are 1 million of those. Just ridiculous. Oh, I'm just asking questions based on ridiculous premises and just complete rabbit trails. And I think that probably the CIA guys and the military intelligence guys and whatever probably laugh about how they don't even need to bother with very much disinformation about it because the kooks just take care of that themselves. They'll run with any, you know, rabbit trail you got.
Yeah.
And now I got myself in a bunch of trouble. So.
No, and there's a great South Park episode about that. If you ever, that basically, you know, we need the conspiracy theories to maintain our power because they think we're evil enough to do these things. So, but thank you for answering the question. And
sure.
I just think,
and it's
know,
a fair question. I'm glad you asked it.
More.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You know what? I ignore that issue too much. I should bring it up at least from time to time to at least make myself clear about it. So thanks for the call. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, okay. We'll be right back.
Y'all.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
All right, guys. You know, with my luck, that'll be, you know, some viral YouTube now. God, please don't anyone make a viral YouTube out of that. I was like, my worst rant of all my Rand Paul rants, the worst one is the one that got passed around 10 million views or whatever. Crap, not that many. I just don't want to suffer the consequences of having to talk about it. I'll say one more thing about it, which is the best article that I've read on the subject of 9/11 lately was by Daniel Lazare at consortiumnews.com. And he's actually funny because he's a guy who wrote a book. He's a liberal who wrote a book about how the Constitution holds the government back too much. And we need a new constitution that allows a more powerful government to help people better and a bunch of crazy crap. Which is just, I don't know, man. How much meth do you gotta smoke to get your brain that addled? I don't understand it. I just don't know. But, he wrote a great piece for Consortium News. In fact, there's two or three of them, so don't get confused. The one, it's Lazare, L-A-Z-A-R-E. And, keyword Moussaoui. Remember Moussaoui? He wasn't really the 20th hijacker. He was going to do something later on. It was, was it Katani? Is that his name? The guy that was more likely to be meant to be the 20th hijacker. But anyway, they called him that. Moussaoui, the guy that in Minneapolis, the FBI busted him in August
And if they had been allowed a foreign intelligence, if they'd been allowed to even go to the FISA court, they would have easily gotten the warrant to search his belongings, and they would have been able to trace his numbers straight to Muhammad Atta and the gang in Florida and could have stopped the attack. But the supervisory special agent would not let them do it. You know, Colleen Rowley is famous for that, for blowing the whistle on that. And anyway, Moussaoui has given some testimony that seems pretty fanciful at first, but then again, I ain't so sure, man. It kind of looks like maybe there's some kind of thing to it. Provides some context, and what Daniel Lazare does is he takes a lot of what he already knows about Saudi Arabia and how it works, and about, you know, the power and influence and the different schemes of people like Bandar and Turkey. That's Prince Turkey, not the nation. And then he combines that with what he's learned from Moussaoui's testimony recently in a deposition for the lawsuit against, I'm not exactly sure, so I won't say. Maybe against the Saudi government, but I'm not certain. But anyway, so this guy Daniel Lazare really goes into explaining the relationship between the decadent princes and the religious leaders who keep the population in check for the princes, and how they share power and the favors they do for each other and this kind of thing, and how this has a lot to do with the princes who have a lot to lose, in fact, backing their enemies, the bin Ladenites, just as they always have. And so, anyway, very interesting stuff, very complicated, so I don't want to just, you know, you'll have to go read it. But it's Daniel Lazare. It's at Bob Perry's site, consortiumnews.com. And it's about the Saudis, and just search Consortium Lazare Saudis, Moussaoui maybe, yeah, and you'll find. There's a couple on the Saudis, more contemporary ones about backing Al-Qaeda in Syria now, for example, which is also very important. But this one is along the lines of Saudi government complicity in the 9/11 attack and the 28 pages and all that kind of thing. And in fact, someone was mentioning to me about, oh yeah, it was Jeff Stein, our friend Jeff Stein from now at Newsweek, who just had a recent report basically saying the same thing again, I think, but more about how the CIA forbid the FBI agents at the joint terrorism room at Alex Station from telling the FBI about the presence of the San Diego cell. Although they were staying with an FBI informant, so for Christ's sake, guys. But anyway, so, and that's the great Jeff Stein, very important article there, so check that out at Newsweek about more from FBI agents complaining about what the CIA wouldn't let them do before September 11th. Yeah. That's interesting stuff, dude. By the way, Stephen Walt coming up in just a minute on the Islamic State now. And we're just going to, I should have figured out what I was going to talk about. Well, the war in Yemen is still going on. Hundreds have been killed. The Saudis are still bombing them. Obama's still picking their targets for them. It's America's war on Yemen is going on right now. I'm sorry I wasn't able to get Jason Ditz on the show for you today to talk about it. But god dang, we got a whole new war. They're calling it a Saudi war, but, you know, come on. It's American boats and planes and spies that are doing the deciding and the coordinating. And it's still going on, and it's an absolutely impossible situation where they're supposedly bombing the former sock puppet Hadi back into power in the capital. But that's just not going to happen any more than you are going to be the next dictator of Yemen either. What are we talking about here? And the fact that the Saudis are bombing the country until they accept him back again only, of course, makes everyone in the whole country hate him that much more. Which, by the way, there was a massive jailbreak. 1,200 people escaped, and they're saying, including a bunch of Al-Qaeda guys. Although they hardly need any jailbreaks to help them now. They got America and Saudi flying as their air force. Right now. Still. Hell, no one even cares, man. We've gone, you know, a week and a half or so without even talking about it on this show. Never mind TV. Yemen? War in Yemen? I don't know. Said TV. I don't even know about it. That's not even on the agenda.
It is at antiwar.com. You can try to keep up there. But yeah, what a mess there, man. Absolute catastrophe. And the consequences from here on there, too, are just going to be, well, messy. And, you know, I mentioned earlier, I did Tom Wood's show today, and he was asking me about, you know, 1 year into the Islamic State, what's the deal? And I really screwed up. I spent too much time on how we got here and not enough time on the Islamic State outside of what used to be Iraq and Syria, where just like Al-Qaeda before them, they have these franchise groups popping up everywhere. Supposedly there's a massive battle going on. Well, I don't know how massive, but some kind of skirmish going on in the Sinai Peninsula. The Egyptian military dictatorship fighting guys hoisting the black flag in Sinai. And you got these guys fighting in Libya and even in Afghanistan, claiming a competing caliphate to Mullah Omar. And doing attacks there and claiming Omar Baghdadi as the real caliph and all this kind of thing. And it's just a brand name, but it's a brand name that signifies an agenda and one that is clearly going to continue to spread chaos throughout. You know, it's amazing, really, isn't it, how despite the catastrophe of the Iraq War, how relatively stable everything still was in 2011 until Barack Obama, not the Arab Spring, until Barack Obama decided to hijack it and wage his counter-revolution against it. Hijack it in Libya and Syria and wage a counter-revolution against it everywhere else. Look at what a mess now. 10,000 bin Ladens, as Mubarak had predicted back then.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Live noon to 2 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network, LRN.FM. And just one guest today, but now it's time for him, finally. It's Stephen M. Walt, professor of international relations at Harvard University, and of course, famously the co-author of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Welcome back to the show, professor. How are you?
I'm just fine. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us on the show today. And I'm sorry if my audio sounds bad. I was told on a Skype call earlier today I've got bad audio. I got a jiggle with this computer's connection, so I hope you can still hear me okay.
You sound great.
Okay, great. So you've written this very interesting article, What Should We Do If the Islamic State Wins? Kind of looks like it's winning. I mostly read Patrick Coburn and Mitchell Prothero when it comes to the news going on over there. And, of course, there's even more news coming out of Syria. But when it comes to their strength in Iraq, Coburn emphasizes that they rule a land the size of Great Britain. They've got a working system of conscription and taxation. They rule a population greater than the majority of UN member states. And they are, that's not a highfalutin name for a group. The Islamic State is a state now. And as he emphasized in one of his recent articles, it's not that they're that powerful, really, but all of their adversaries are extraordinarily weak and none of them get along with each other. And shrug, it looks like maybe they are here to stay. What do you think?
Well, I think it's important to sort of clarify what we mean by winning. In my piece, I suggested that winning means precisely what you just said, that they managed to stay in power in more or less the area they control. I think the more important thing is that they're not going to spread around the world. They're not the beginnings of some vast revolutionary wave that is going to engulf the entire Middle East and beyond, although some of ISIS's leaders would like to do that. You know, we hear phrases like, you know, they control territory greater than Great Britain or larger than Great Britain. Most of that territory is pretty worthless desert. You know, they've got no significant industry, not a lot of natural resources, not, in fact, an enormous, well-educated advanced population. So it's still a, you know, powerful by the standards of maybe some terrorist organizations, but very weak by the standards of some states. Mm-hmm. The question we ought to ask ourselves is, if they don't collapse anytime soon, how is the outside world going to deal with them?
Right. Well, important question. I mean, they're landlocked, so that's good. And at least officially, they don't have any allies, although certainly the Turks don't seem, they have the power, I guess, to dislodge them, to attack them, but they seem to prefer them to the Kurds anyway. And to Assad too. And so, who is to do something about him? I admit, and I'm proud to admit how wrong I was about this. A year ago, I just said, look, it's a matter of months before they send in the paratroopers, the 3rd Infantry Division, the Marine Corps, to rouse these guys out of Mosul. Because how can they possibly politically withstand this guy who's basically bin Laden himself up there on the balcony, declaring himself the dictator? And I was totally wrong about that. Apparently American politics and the American military establishment would rather let him be than do what it really would take to get rid of him, thank goodness. But yeah, other than that, who could take him? You think Iran might actually really invade with their whole army to try to get rid of these guys at some point?
No, I think that's unlikely too. And I think what you're seeing here is the fact that most of ISIS's adversaries, and they have plenty, understand that they are not, in fact, a mortal threat. They're a problem, and we don't want to minimize the degree to which they're a problem. But as you've just indicated, right, the Turks don't like ISIS, but they're worried that anything might happen there that might strengthen the Kurds or enhance a Kurdish bid for independence at some point down the road. So Turkey is ambivalent. Similarly, Saudi Arabia doesn't like ISIS very much, but also doesn't like Assad. So they're not willing to commit themselves full force here. Iran and the United States, we don't like ISIS, but we don't like each other very much. And we're reluctant to do anything that might enhance Iranian influence in Iraq even more. Of course, Iran doesn't want to do anything that might enhance American influence in Iraq. So in a sense, all of the parties that are opposed to ISIS have various disagreements amongst themselves. And if they really saw ISIS as the most serious threat they faced, that it really was going to start taking over, you would expect to see that coalition come together to do something about it. But in fact, most of its members have other priorities, which is why you're not seeing a really concerted all-out effort to go at what is ultimately a problem, but again, not an existential danger.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wonder, are you surprised that even after the declaration of the caliphate, that they have continued to back the rebels and arm the rebels and work with Turkey and Saudi to back the rebels, now even rehabilitating al-Qaeda? I almost can't believe it. An article in Foreign Affairs, accepting al-Qaeda, the enemy of America's enemy. Let's rebrand the people who are still sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City, because, hey, at least he's not Assad. And I'm not saying that America should be backing Assad in this case, but it seems like the American government would think that, hey, Assad is the best guy, that he's the moderate with his clean-shaven chin, if anybody is, to keep al-Nusra and the Islamic State at bay. And yet here we are a year after the declaration of the caliphate, and America is still on the side of, you know, I guess they say al-Qaeda or al-Nusra and ISIS are enemies, but they have basically the same agenda still, even though they fight amongst each other some. They're still the rebels against Assad together. And I wonder what you think of that. It seems absolutely amazing to me. As amazing as it was in the lead up to the declaration of the caliphate, it's 10 times as amazing now, no?
Well, maybe you shouldn't be so amazed. I mean, what's really going on here is the recognition that the United States does not have a significant dog in this particular fight. The United States is a country, you know, with 300 million or more people, a $17 trillion economy, mighty military forces. We're far from dangers, no hostile states near our borders, etc. And ultimately, American security isn't significantly affected by who is governing Syria, who's governing Anbar province. You know, we have tended to exaggerate the strategic importance of a lot of these areas. And I think what you're seeing now is a tacit recognition that, in fact, you know, we don't have to try and play kingmaker there and figure out who's actually going to run the place. The second thing, of course, is that I think we now know that if the United States were to get actively involved, particularly on any kind of large scale, it would be likely to backfire. It would play into precisely the narrative that the Islamic State uses, a narrative of, you know, crusaders and Western imperialism and American interference. And the more the United States does, the more that narrative sort of takes hold, particularly among the Sunni population that, you know, resents the fact that we overthrew Saddam, resents the fact that we bungled the occupation, resents the fact that we've backed a government in Baghdad that didn't treat the Sunni population of Iraq particularly well. So I think what you're also seeing is a recognition that as bad as that situation might appear, and it certainly is a real curse for the people living under ISIS's control, the United States could easily make it worse by trying to go in there again and clean the whole place up. This, I think, is going to be one of those unfortunate tragedies where we're just going to have to try to contain the problem and wait till things, for lack of a better phrase, sort of burn themselves out. Mm-hmm.
All right, well, I guess music's about to start playing. We're going to have to go out to this break. But on the other side of the break, I'll ask you, Stephen, whether you think that containment means training up the Iraqi army again, you know, at least in Shiistan, more money, more guns for the Kurds up north, the possible consequences of that. Jordan, Egypt, Saudi, the rest of the American allies in the region and their roles. But hang tight right there. We'll be right back with Stephen Walt from foreignpolicy.com in just a sec, y'all.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Talking with Stephen Walt from Harvard and foreignpolicy.com about this piece, paging up. It's called, What Should We Do If the Islamic State Wins? And again, he clarified, he doesn't mean come and conquer the middle part of North America. He just means if they can hold on to the peace that they've carved out of Western Iraq and Eastern Syria so far, basically, and that's what we're talking about here, and what should be done about it. And he's saying not invade, contain them. It can be done. There's plenty of precedent for it. But now I wonder what exactly that means, because we talked earlier about the tension between the Turks and the Kurds, for example. And if America goes arming up the Kurds, they seem to have less and less in common with the Shiite government in Baghdad these days. And I wonder whether that might just accidentally lead to a whole other war between Iraqi Kurdistan and who knows who else in the neighborhood.
Right. Well, the central thing to remember is that ISIS is primarily a problem for the people in the area it controls and for the countries that are its immediate neighbors. And it's ultimately their job to deal with it, not ours. I think there are reasons to question whether or not additional American military training is really even going to help. You know, we've poured billions of dollars and many years into trying to train Iraqi security forces, and they haven't been willing to fight very effectively in the battlefield, as the U.S. Secretary of Defense pointed out last month. Moreover, that in a sense it fuels the continued problems between Sunni and Shia in Iraq, because the Baghdad government is Shia dominated. If we pour lots of money into building up a primarily Shia army, that's not going to win much popularity in the areas where the Islamic State now is. The other problem with sort of viewing this as an American project is that the more we do, the more everybody else in the region will just free ride on our efforts. There's a long history of that going on. So I think while there may be a sort of limited role for the United States to play, ultimately we have to recognize that the Islamic State is not likely to spread very far. It's going to be, I think, relatively easy for its neighbors to contain. And the American role should be very much a sort of backstopping role at most, and not particularly alarmist. One final element to that is we ought to recognize that a group like ISIS, through its use of social media, is going to be able to inspire some degree of, you know, copycat or lone wolf type attacks, and we've already seen a number of those in a number of places. That's going to happen. The good news, such as it is that those dangers are relatively modest. Some people are going to be affected. Some people are going to die, but it won't be a large number. And it's certainly not going to be sufficient to destabilize whole regions or, you know, overcome other countries unless we, you know, sort of take the bait, fall into their trap and do a lot of stupid things that facilitate their efforts to win additional sympathizers elsewhere. One final point I'd make is that, you know, that this is a radical organization. And although it's been more effective than I think many people expected at the beginning, it's got lots of internal divisions within it. It's prone to quarrel with others. It likes to condemn anyone who disagrees with it, including other Muslims, as infidels and apostates and heretics. This is not an organization, in short, that's likely to be very popular either where it currently exists or anywhere else. Again, it'll attract some degree of sympathizers in other places, but not very many of them. And I think, you know, we can, you know, take a rather measured view of the danger it poses and wait for it to burn itself out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's a lot of what happened to ISIS Jr. back when it was Al-Qaeda in Iraq in 2006 was they just pushed their luck pushing everyone around. It wasn't just that they had to deal with the Americans and the Shiite militias, but in the lands where they were supposedly welcome, they found themselves quickly pretty unwelcome. And it seems like, you know, yeah, I agree that that's certainly the best hope, that they'll just have so little legitimacy over the lands that they already control that they'll undermine themselves from within. Seems likely the way they crucify people for, you know, victimless crimes and this kind of thing. I mean, they're way out of control.
We've seen this movie in some earlier historical episodes. You know, after the Bolshevik Revolution back in 1917, you know, a number of people in the West who were sympathetic to it flocked to Moscow because they wanted to support the revolution and they thought it was the wave of the future. And in many cases, these were people who rapidly became disillusioned by what they saw and by how things ultimately proceeded. So, you know, the same sort of thing, I think, is already, there's some evidence this is happening with ISIS. It's got people coming from different parts of the world to support it. But once they get there, they discover it's not some sort of wonderful Islamic paradise. It's actually a rather brutal, unforgiving regime, which doesn't, in fact, have a lot of resources, doesn't have a lot it can do for the people under its control. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to have enough confidence, you know, both in our own institutions, but also in institutions elsewhere in the Middle East, that they will ultimately prove more appealing than the 7th century vision that ISIS is putting forward.
Mm-hmm. Now, it seems like over all these years, whether we're fighting against them like in Iraq War II or fighting for them like in Libya in 2011, our government just is, as Michael Scheuer once said, bin Laden's indispensable ally, even in death, spreading, accomplishing his goals for them, basically. And I'm sure you're familiar with Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's bin Laden unit, and he can be very hawkish at times. And I saw an interview with him on Lou Dobbs where he was talking about how crazy it was that we were backing the Mujahideen against Assad. And Lou Dobbs asked him, well, should we back Assad against them? And I thought he might say, yeah, you know. And he goes, no, because that, he's getting smart again, not angry. That will play right into their narrative that it's America and the Jewish Israelis and the Shiite apostates. They're all in it against us true believers and this kind of thing. Fight the battle of Armageddon at Dabiq and whatever, this kind of deal. Just like what they want. And I wonder whether you think very many people in Washington, D.C. understand what you were explaining about how
you know, what their narrative is, how important it is to their narrative that they're the enemies of the Americans, and how counterproductive it might be to even switch sides to those who are fighting against them in Syria, or to keep backing their enemies like in Iraq right now.
Well, I think there are people in Washington who do understand the risks or the danger of acting in ways that reinforce the message that our opponents are trying to convey. I think President Obama gets that. He understands that, you know, we want to be careful not to appear to fulfill the kinds of, you know, prophecies or analyses that the other side is putting forward. But I think what is often forgotten in Washington, because our foreign policy establishment really is addicted to a high level of global activism and trying to run the world, is that, first of all, you know, power, and especially military power, is a pretty crude instrument. And when you use it, it always generates unintended consequences. It always has effects you can't fully anticipate. Second, that social engineering, trying to remake other societies along the sort of American model, is extremely hard to do. It almost never works. We've seen it fail in Iraq. We've seen it fail in Afghanistan. We've seen it fail in Libya, fail in Yemen, etc. And that we need to approach a lot of these problems with a certain degree of humility, that we're not going to be able to fix them. And the more we try, the more likely it is we'll just make things worse. You know, as something we ought to know from our own national experience, you know, people don't like taking orders from foreigners, even if those foreigners are well-intentioned. And when we show up with a lot of capability and a lot of force and a lot of power, it naturally generates a lot of resentment, even when we're there ostensibly to help others. And finally, that trying to come in and reorder the entire Middle East isn't necessary. It's not essential to American national security that we turn that entire region into a set of pro-American democracies, even if we knew how to do that. And if the United States, you know, backed off more, allowed those countries to govern themselves without as much American interference, I think we would find ourselves actually more popular in the region. We would face less hostility from groups like ISIS, and those groups would have much more trouble gaining any purchase in other societies. But that calls for a real revolution in how the United States approaches much of the world, and especially the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, when you talk about the relative weakness of the Islamic State, I know you're not being Pollyanna about it. You're trying to be realistic in the face of hysteria and that kind of thing, basically. But at the same time, you know, like you talked about, it's in their interest to pick a fight with us, to get them to get us to fall for the same trick of you know, escalating over there and playing into their hands and that kind of thing. But I wonder whether you think that maybe in Washington, D.C., that they are, you know, a little bit too naive, you know, for their own good about just how dangerous these guys ultimately could be when it comes to that kind of thing. That, again, they're pursuing this policy still of trying to train up and arm moderates to work. There's the new Army of Conquest and whatever, continuing to follow this policy in Syria, even after the rise of the caliphate, the declaration of the caliphate a year ago, and that kind of thing. Do they just think that, you know, oh, well, I mean, Obama explained to Jeffrey Goldberg, or they talked about it in the Atlantic interview in 2012, that, yeah, you know, weakening Assad or getting rid of Assad, replacing him with a democratic government or however they phrase it, would be a great way to weaken Iran's authority, you know, power and influence in the region. You know, yeah. So I wonder if you think that they think that, really, yeah, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, whatever, they're basically just a bunch of kooks waving AK-47s over their head. They're no real threat, but Iran really still is the threat. And so maybe they actually don't mind the caliphate so much, even a year into it, as long as they're helping to contain the Iranian revolution that Bush Jr. imported into the southern part of Iraq in 03. And has solidified since then. And this is that redirection from 2007, right, to back the Sunnis, even the jihadists, if it means weakening Iran. And I'm sorry, because I know I sound too truth-free conspiratorial about it, but I'm just trying to be, you know, New Yorker magazine about it.
Well, I guess I it would be at one level sort of reassuring to think that we had a really sophisticated, subtle, you know, playing playing our enemies off against each other kind of strategy. I don't think we've been anywhere near that skillful. I think we've sort of blundered along, and we've avoided in recent years some of the bigger mistakes we had made in the past. But I don't think that what's driving U.S. policy is the kind of really sophisticated and I might even say sort of ruthlessly Machiavellian approach that you just laid out there. I think that the administration understands that ISIS is not a mortal threat, which is why their response has been measured. Unfortunately, in Washington and in big segments of the media, there are people who like to spend a lot of time threat inflating and offering a very alarmist views, either as a way to sort of wage partisan political warfare or because that's a way of getting people to watch cable news, right? With lurid tales about beheadings and a sort of 24/7 cycle of paranoia. ISIS is a group that has maybe 30 to 50,000 people under arms, most of them badly trained, not particularly well armed. That's sort of the size of a couple of American infantry divisions. We're told that it has revenues of, $2 million a week, which sounds like a lot at first glance, but, by the standards of a state, that's really quite paltry. They don't have significant resources. The one place where I would agree with what you had to say is that, if you step back and look at what America's overall strategic interest in the Middle East. For decades, it has been to make sure the Middle East remained divided. It wasn't controlled by a single hostile power that, might manipulate the oil supply or do other things that we would find objectionable. And one could argue that today the Middle East is more divided today than it has been in any period in recent memory. That has various unfortunate consequences, both for the people there, but also because it does spill over in small ways outside. But in terms of the United States facing a real strategic threat emanating from the Middle East, I think that, in a sense, is more remote than it might have been at other times. There is, I think, a long-term concern with Iran as a potential regional power, which is, I think, why the administration has been working very hard to cap Iran's nuclear program and then eventually work towards a more constructive relationship with Iran, hoping that Iran's own policies moderate over time. And at the same time, doing what we can to reassure others in the region that we're going to strive for a balance of power over the longer term. But I guess as I look at the Middle East today, the thought that any country is going to be able to dominate that region, whether it's Iran or Turkey or Saudi Arabia or Egypt, or any radical groups are going to be able to try and dominate the region, I think that's very remote now and is likely to be quite remote for, several decades to come.
And I'm sorry if I made it sound like I thought that Bush had deliberately imported the Iranian Revolution with the War of 2003. Obviously, that was his gigantic mistake, that they weren't going to get the Hashemite Kingdom of the Clean Break paper after all. So I didn't mean to say that. That obviously would have been off the deep end. But, I mean, they are, as we talked about, and I'm sorry I'm keeping you over. If you got to go, it's okay. But they are still, yeah. They would have us believe that Al-Qaeda is the lesser evil than Assad in Syria right now. So that policy of getting rid of him to weaken Iran apparently has not gone away. Or am I oversimplifying it too much? Or?
Well, I think it's just illustrating how complicated this situation is and how, none of these parties are really parties that we want to be particularly close to. Certainly one doesn't want to embrace Assad and say, all is forgiven. But the fact is that because of the complexity there, because of the fact that we don't have reliable instruments of influence with most of these groups, it's very hard to anticipate what the results of any significant American intervention would be. As we've seen in other contexts like Libya, even an intervention that succeeds and accomplishes exactly what we wanted it to accomplish, which in the case of Libya was the removal of the Gaddafi regime, ultimately produces the result that we didn't want, which was a failed state and a place where extremists can go and cause more trouble. So I think, again, this is a the real prescription here is for a certain degree of humility about what the United States can and can't accomplish in this context, and the recognition that fortunately our national security and prosperity does not depend on what happens there.
Right. All right. I'm sorry for keeping you so long. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. Appreciate it.
Sure thing. Pleasure talking with you.
Okay, guys, that is Stephen Walt. He teaches at Harvard and writes at foreignpolicy.com.